thanks for coming out on a Sunday morning. I know there's often lots of other competing things you'd prefer to be doing. This panel is part of a broader project that's been taking place throughout the Adelaide Film Festival called the Dome Project. All of the people you see sitting up here have all participated in various strands of that project, and we thought it could be interesting to look at organising the discussion around a film model, because that seems to be what people know about and are comfortable with. So we're really going to be presenting the panel in terms of the production issues involved with Full Dome, and also the exhibition and distribution kind of models that exist now and potential for the future. The reason we're doing all this is because in the last few years, the technology for Full Dome has made it more and more affordable and thus more and more accessible to artists and filmmakers, and it has also meant that the content has broken away from the astronomical focus that it has had in fixed domes, because, you know, obviously those domes cost a lot of money to set up, and their whole focus is science education. So we're finding that people are creating more and more content which is either engaging with other sciences or more broadly the arts. And what I see is an opportunity for filmmakers and artists working with moving images. There is a growing market. There are now over 500 of these screens internationally. They need content. And also, they give, I think, that they are a fabulous creative opportunity to create really immersive and experiential moving image programs. At the moment, there's not a lot of narrative-driven work. It's mainly kind of experimental or animations or educational, but it is starting to break out, and I'm really glad that we've been able to bring this fabulous group of people together at the beginning of the time of Full Dome. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Jenny Zaya, who we're very lucky to have in Adelaide. She's had over 7 years or close to 7 years experience working for Skyscan, which is one of the large technology providers for the fixed and larger domes, and is now working at Rising Sun Pictures here in Adelaide. And we're very lucky to have her here. So please, if you could welcome Jenny, and she'll introduce everyone.
Thank you, Vicky. That was lovely. So just wanted to continue with where Vicky left off. Our discussion today revolves around the rapid uptake of Full Dome technology and our opportunities surrounding distribution, production and exhibition for artists and filmmakers. Before I introduce our panellists gathered today, I'll just introduce you a bit about myself. I used to work in IT before I decided I really hated it, and went off and studied feature film, and currently work for Rising Sun Pictures working on visual effects for feature films such as Harry Potter and those kinds of things. So when I was working in documentaries, I actually went to the American Museum of Natural History when I was researching dinosaurs and cool things in paleontology. I happened to visit the Rowe Centre for Astronomical and Planetary Sciences, where I walked into a planetarium for the first time. And like I'm sure everybody else here, walking into a dome, it's just amazing, this huge dome canvas, and just wanting to put stuff on it immediately. I came back to Australia and immediately wrote to Skyscan, which I knew was a major vendor, and it just so happened they had a Melbourne office, and I got a job with Jack White producing Infinity Express, and that was one of Skyscan's first soirees into the Full Dome production. So let me give you a bit brief history on planetariums. Planetariums were obviously created to simulate the night sky. That's why you see the star projectors in the middle, those big ant antenna-like things. From the moment planetariums were in existence, artists became a part of this world, always pushing the capabilities of the dome systems. Planetariums would always take new technologies on board, such as slide and video projectors, creating a whole new multimedia type of projections. Melbourne Planetarium had this for a long time, and they really pushed the limits with their artistic creations. Okay, so Full Dome evolved from these multimedia planetariums. There were these slide projectors that would be on the periphery of the domes, and they'd create an all-sky image. These slide projectors were then moved over to video projectors, and the all-sky images played back at 30 frames a second, so you got a sequential, you know, moving image on the screen. So Full Dome was invented. This happened approximately 1995, when a group of technology vendors thought about this great concept, and it actually premiered in London in 1998. As Vicky mentioned, there's 500 domes approximately, full domes approximately in existence. Over half of those are the smaller domes, 8 metres, such as the one in Adelaide at Mawson Lakes. Theatres popping up everywhere, from the typical museum institutions, they're in schools, universities, even malls, art installations, conferences, festivals, exhibits, and recently commercial product promotions. There was one, Cartier, the jewellery company, actually exhibited something in Florida, and raves and nightclubs, quite popular actually. With the uptake of the Full Dome environment, there are several universities adding Full Dome to their curriculum. One of those is the University of New Mexico, where David Bining is involved. There's Glendale Community College, the University of Plymouth in the UK, and the University Kiel, Germany. Just Australia has had a really long association with Full Dome. Besides having Full Dome vendors and technology partners such as Skyscan, Cosmodome, Miles is here from Cosmodome, and Swinburne University, we had the first Full Dome installation in the Southern Hemisphere, which occurred in Perth and Brisbane simultaneously back in, I think, 2003. And the Mirror Dome technology was created at Swinburne University by Paul Burke. With technology advancements in both production and presentations, Full Dome is becoming more accessible to content and producers, which is why we're here to discuss this. And given that it's now 10 years old, and I saw a wide gamut of productions and being distributed to theatres, so I'll just quickly have a brief overview of more of the commercial successes. There was a generation previous to my own which enjoyed lasers in the planetarium world, and such as Laser Pink Floyd, which was made famous recently with South Park episodes. But more recently, back in 2004, the American Museum produced Sonic Vision, which was a collaboration between the American Museum of Natural History, MOBI, and it was a team of about 6 artists under the creative influence of director Chris Harvey. There have been many more music videos following suit, none quite as successful as Sonic Vision. There's been very CG-orientated productions, quite with really great production values, very Pixar-esque production values, such as Kaluakahina, The Enchanted Reef by Soft Machine, DE, and Molecularium by Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Those two productions had very science-orientated slant, but not astronomy science. There's been experimentational live action footage productions such as Romeo and Juliet, which was shot on 35mm, and it was in association with ARRI video cameras. One of the first productions to overcome the challenges of live action was Black Holes by the Denver Museum of Natural History and Sciences, and they actually wrote a white paper on it entitled Live Action Film Footage for an Astronomy Full Dome Show, where it documented their experiences and challenges and solutions to their pipeline and a formation for best practices of live action footage on the dome. And another live action is John Wiley's Heart of the Sun. That was taking old IMAX footage, Solar Max, and warping it and putting it on the dome. And that actually received Australian Film Finance Corporation sponsorship to produce that show. As technologies advance, planetary remain at the forefront of developing these technologies. We've seen the occurrence of 4K projectors, such as the Sony SXRD technology, laser projectors, and real-time simulation software, and we've even seen gaming technology come into play recently. There are two ways this technology is going: the really small domes, very similar to Mawson Lakes, and the really large domes, such as Beijing Planetarium. They just got a 32 million pixel system, which is 8K by 8K. Another area of interest is the stereoscopic area. We've seen about five planetariums actually take up full dome stereoscopic, and I think we actually debuted that at Dome Fest in 2007 at David Binning's place. With no further ado, I would like to introduce the dome panelists. We have David Binning, visionary founder and director of the Dome Fest Festival, and he's also the associate director of immersive media at University of New Mexico Arts Lab. We have Monica Zetlin, Melbourne producer, Melbourne Full Dome producer, Melbourne Planetarium Full Dome producer, I should say. We have Scott Hessels, acclaimed media artist and filmmaker, currently lecturer at the School of Art, Design and Media at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. We have Warwick Lawrence, Melbourne-based animator and at the Melbourne Planetarium. We have Amanda Phillips, Adelaide-based choreographer and creative producer. And we have Peter Morse, an Australian digital media producer. So I would also now like to welcome Chris Luke to the area up here. He's the professional astronomer at the Centre for Astrophysics and Supercomputing at Swinburne University.
So I think panels are all about asking questions. And I hope the question you're asking is, what's an astronomer like you doing at an arts symposium like this? Let me give you a little analogy from the world that I work in. This is the Keck Observatory in Hawaii. It's at about 3,200 metres above sea level on the top of a volcano. Inside each of those domes is a 300-tonne telescope with a diameter of 10 metres, made up of 36 individual segments. You can't actually build a mirror that big because gravitationally it will actually fall apart. This is one of the most significant telescopes in the world, and it costs a lot of money to run, but it's essential that it's there. But fortunately, we also have little telescopes like these, and little telescopes like these can be used for anyone to do whatever they like with. You can experiment a lot more yourself with a little telescope. So here's the Rose Center that Jenny mentioned in New York, the Hayden Planetarium, and it is one of the early full dome systems. And when it was built, it cost a lot of money and was in a very specialized location and could do amazing things that you couldn't ordinarily do. But there was somehow a bit of a disconnect between the very large facilities 10 years ago and opportunities for more people to just get in and experiment. And that's where now we're starting to see a revolution of some sort with portable domes. And of course, with portable domes, what you need is a way to project. And I kind of like this image on the left here. It's a juxtaposition of the old star ball and the new, a fisheye projector that you can just make out. It's this thing here, a fisheye lens sitting on top of a projector. And that's one way of producing a full dome experience in a smaller dome at low cost, because rather than some great big 28-pipe silicon graphics machine, which you needed to run the original Hayden system, you can run that sort of planetarium off a single laptop. And that's what we did with our system, Mirror Dome, even more simple. A half spherical lens with a projector sitting in front of it, an idea that Paul Burke, who was working at Swinburne University at the time, developed. And you can actually see we're just running that off a laptop. Once you have a portable system like this at low cost, then it does start to open up more options for experimentation. So why am I, as an astrophysicist, so interested in the opportunities that digital domes give us? Well, first of all, I have to put my education hat on and say, you know, planetarium domes are quite nice places to teach you about the night sky. I was trying to think of a slightly provocative statement to say, and on my way here this morning, I was speculating that perhaps we should stop showing the night sky in planetariums. So someone might like to ask me about that later on. But you can't see it terribly well there with the contrast in this room. But putting the night sky onto a dome is, I guess, the way that we started. But what digital projection lets you do that the star balls didn't let you do is to explore other objects. And that's where I perhaps got my first connection into the full dome world, was a piece that we were doing initially as a 2D animation of what it would be like to fly through the universe. And we did this as a pure science visualization, data from an experiment called the 2DF Galaxy Redshift Survey. They were the first survey in the world to get 120,000 galaxies with their correct 3D space positions. And an opportunity came up for us to produce a full dome version of this, thanks to Jack White, who's in the audience. And so that move from 2D screen to for us to see what it was like then to put this into a dome and the other types of objects that you could explore. Most of our work actually at Swinburne in animation has really been concentrating on 3D rather than dome work. But more recently, an opportunity came up for us to work in a stereoscopic dome. And I'm actually disappointed I haven't had a chance to go and look at one of these systems myself. So I'm hoping in the future I'll get that chance. From a research point of view, though, there's a somewhat strange thing that happens in the astronomy world. Like facilities like Keck and various other multi-million and in some case, looking into the future, billion-dollar astronomy research projects, we spend all this money on the hardware and the getting the data, and then like any good astronomer does, we cluster around a tiny little flat two-dimensional display. And one of the motivations for me for getting involved with the mirror dome idea was to see what it would be like to explore data actually back on the dome, to see whether we could, as astronomers, learn more about our own data sets by using that dome technology. And I'm hoping that's something that I'll be continuing to pursue. But the final thing now is to try and talk to you a little bit about my connection now into art, which came out of some of the outreach work that I was doing, particularly through 3D, and supported by the excellent people at ANAT. And so Vicky and Melinda, I have to thank you so much for your support in encouraging me and encouraging artists to come and spend some time with these crazy astronomers and their technology. And we currently have Willow Wayland and Nikki Forster working with us on a project, not dome-related. Maybe in future residencies we might explore that as well. But just the opportunities to think about art as a different way of interpreting and presenting astronomy knowledge. And for me, the dome actually plays a very strong part in the reason that I'm finally here as an astronomer. It was as a 10-year-old or so boy that my parents took me to the old Melbourne Planetarium and its star field. And it was something actually as simple as that star field that made me realise that there was actually more out in the night sky than just the planets and the rocket ships and Star Wars films that a 10-year-old boy was interested in. And I went home that night and looked at the stars properly for the first time. And now, 25-something years later, here I am a professional astronomer talking to you about that. So my question, perhaps to pose now for the panel to think about and for the rest of you to think about, is how can we use the digital dome to inspire? And whether that is educationally, or whether that's through research, or whether that's through something else entirely different. So that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
I'm Warwick Lawrence. I'm an animator working at the Melbourne Planetarium. Just to introduce myself, I spent about 10 years working in the film industry, mainly as a camera assistant. Ah, thank you. So I was working mainly as a camera assistant in the film industry for about 10 years and eventually got into computer animation and was fortunate enough to find myself working at the Melbourne Planetarium. Today, what I'm going to present to you is largely sort of some works that have been done over the last 3 years at the Melbourne Planetarium. I'm hoping this doesn't seem a bit like Full Dome 101 when I go through this, but I wanted to sort of like talk about how we actually get content up onto the dome and sort of see how that works in comparison to the film analogy. So to start with, our production pipeline is very similar to filmmaking. I mean, if you look through that list, we pretty much do everything that you're doing in a film production. Probably the two things that do stick out is when we go to, after we've done a storyboard, we do an animated storyboard, which we call an animatic. That's an essential part. It's something that gives us all the timing for the show. And then from that point, we can actually start to break out individual scenes. And normally what we're doing in production is we're working out who's going to be working on individual scenes. And so those scenes will be worked on individually. And then eventually we start to produce lots of short tests, which we'll put into an assembly edit to sort of see how all that's working. At some stage, we do the narration and then music and effects. And then finally, what sort of happens is that we try and all bring it all together, but we've got to do these huge final resolution renders, which can be months worth of rendering. So that kind of is sort of happening in the same time that we're trying to madly get all the music done as well. Just wanted to talk a little bit about storyboards. Storyboarding for us is a very interesting issue because you're always trying to present stuff, how it's going to look on a full dome. How do you present something that's going to be on a hemispherical surface in 2D that's going to be understood? So we've got different examples from some of our storyboards there. The one down the bottom there was from a show called Problem with Pluto. As you look at that screen, basically with any full dome plate, usually the bottom of the screen is towards the front that you'd be looking. At the top is kind of what's happening, the action that's happening behind you. For the one on the top right is one from our show called Black Holes, and we actually brought a graphic artist in to do that for us. But one of the things we were finding also with these storyboards is they're really hard for our stakeholders to understand them. Like, people look at them and they can't visualise how that's going to appear on the dome. So we've actually started now experimenting with this format, which is the top left one for our new show, where we're kind of showing half of a dome, really, and that circle kind of represents the top of the dome there and kind of what would sort of like be happening behind you. Actually, I find the one thing that works for that is trying to indicate screen direction on it seems to be work a lot more efficiently than the round ones that we've been doing. So, how do we get images up there? There's basically five different ways we can look at putting images up there. We can use a real-time system. Melbourne Planetarium has got a digital sky system which allows us to put up stars and planets. They use it. Our usual show is to have a pre-rendered show playing, but they'll also do a live presentation of what's in the sky tonight, and they'll use the real-time system to show what planets are going to be seen and all the star alignments. We're finding, like, we can use some of those elements in our shows, but we're finding now, because we're trying to do all our shows pre-rendered so we can actually sell them overseas quite easily, that we're no really longer using the real-time system as much as what we did. Okay, so we can put up photographs and stills quite easily. As soon as you're going to put photographs up, they've got to be warped to match the dome surface. The top right images, or both those images, are from our show Black Holes. The top right one is a lot of still photographs that have obviously been warped to match that dome surface. You can sort of see that. And we'll use different compositing programs such as After Effects or Digital Fusion, so it allows us to do that. And then once they're in there and warped to that surface, we can still manipulate them around and move them around. The bottom one was also from Black Holes, and it's almost like a watercolour image that I actually used a paint program to create all these layers and then warp them all in After Effects and put the whole thing together. So besides that, we have traditional video. Now, standard video can't be used to fill the dome. Our dome is something like 3200 pixel by 3200 pixel. There's no camera that can actually film or capture that for us. So when we're using video like this, you've got to try and work out imaginative ways of kind of embodying that. This next clip I'm just going to show you comes from a show which was called The Problem with Pluto. And it's the story of the ghost of an astronomer who arrives on a spaceship that's heading out to Pluto. So I apologise for the low quality of this one, but I'll just...
That sounds more scientific.
Scientific?
As you can see, I'm right here. Percival Lowell, intrepid traveller, renowned astronomer, scientific philanthropist, explorer of the night sky, at your service.
Okay. Now, probably the most used method for getting content up there that we're doing at the moment is to use computer animation, CG animation. We use the main programs we're using at the moment are 3D Studio Max, Lightwave. We're currently now using a world-generating software called Vue, more and more, particularly for their last show. It's a climate show. We're doing a lot of scenes based on Earth, so we're finding this is particularly fantastic software for Full Dome because it's creating environments, if you like, so it's almost creating worlds. So I'll show you this next clip now. It's a scene where we're flying over Antarctica, and it was all basically modelled in Vue. There's some buildings in there which are actually done in Lightwave, but I'm not sure how well you'll sort of understand the way the camera moves through it. So you have to imagine this on a dome. And I've actually sped this up to about twice the speed for the sake of this. And the final way that's coming in, really, is Full Dome Video. And they are now developing cameras that are going to be capable of shooting 4K by 4K. And I think it will become one of the really more dominant ways of producing content, particularly if we're looking at doing non-astronomy stuff. This would be just like a typical shot. This is actually a shot, just a still shot. I believe Peter's going to hopefully show us some 4K footage or some Full Dome Video as well. But again, it's just like incredibly expensive at the moment to get done, and they really haven't got the cameras and the lenses all kind of working together to do it in a big planetarium. For a small planetarium or a small dome, it can actually be done. As I said, I think it'll become more and more dominant as we go. So I just want to talk a little bit about some of the design issues that we've got to consider when we're producing stuff. When you're putting stuff in a dome, you have a lot of cross-reflection. The light comes, the projector's up onto the screen, but it starts to bounce around and everything becomes totally desaturated. And so things that look, when you're working on it, they'll look fantastic on your monitor, as this scene from a show called Tycho to the Moon was done. And I probably won't even sort of see this because it's already looking very desaturated up there, actually. It's kind of tried to simulate what it looks like when you put it onto your monitor, and it suddenly becomes much more desaturated. It can be quite frustrating. And the way we try and work around that is to quite often use a lot of black on the screen. That quite works well for astronomy shows, but not necessarily for a show like the one we've got up there. So you're usually trying to sort of just do a lot of work with trying to get the colours looking right and nicely saturated on screen. Next, other design issue. Seating arrangements. Seating arrangements quite interesting in domes. There's basically two seating arrangements. The traditional planetariums have what's called concentric, where everyone's facing in circles, all looking up to the middle. That's starting to change now. We're having more and more unidirectional ones, where everyone's kind of facing in the one direction. But when you're creating content for something, you have to kind of consider, how's it going to work in each of these domes? In a concentric one, basically most of your action really has to happen up at the zenith, because everyone can see the zenith. If you have it sort of on one side, half the audience is going to miss it. So these are sort of design considerations. Next one we talk about is whether it's a horizontal or tilted dome. Obviously, most portable domes are all going to be horizontal, and the traditional domes are horizontal, but apparently a lot more tilted domes are getting built. And, like, for example, where do you put your action? So, go. I'll just go over here. Oh, I can't go there. Give it to me. In a horizontal dome, you'll have a sweet spot which is kind of more towards. You can put it more to the front. I find when you're in a tilted dome, you have to put it more towards the zenith again, because that's kind of like a higher level of view where people can sort of generally see it. So you kind of considering that. It's also like something in that scene. You've got, where's the placement of the horizon? You look at the where it's on the horizontal dome sort of goes right round. As soon as you put that onto a tilted dome, it can look quite different. So you have to kind of balance which sorts of domes you're actually making this content for. Okay, so the last section I wanted to talk to you about is comparing film to full dome. The first thing about full dome is it's immersive. It's an incredibly immersive medium, much more than film. And for me, working in this, I like to use this construct. So rather than seeing the dome as sort of simply something that's a curved screen that we can put stuff on, I like to sort of imagine it more as this device that's taking you to different new worlds, to new places. So it's a very immersive device for that, and that's quite a difference. And if I keep that construct in my head, it always is pushing me to how I'm going to use that space. So some of the differences. If I talk about composition, film dome has no edges, and as soon as the screenwriter goes, okay, and then the spaceship moves off camera right, you go, well, the spaceship can't move off camera right. There is no right for it to move off to. So there's got these issues. Full dome, you don't have any golden triangle. You might have in a sort of standard cinema frame. But that said, all domes have sweet spots that you're kind of working towards. And while it's good to have your action in those sweet spots, it's really important to make use of the rest of the dome, so that you've got elements that might appear from behind you, or they can go around the dome, to really make use of that. We also quite often might use panoramas, which could be a simple device of like a series of clocks appearing around the screen we did in one show, just to make people turn their heads all the way around and really appreciate the space that they're in. The other issues I've got there are sort of more standard design issues, just avoiding symmetry and using elements of different sizes, but they're kind of more standard elements that we're kind of considering when we're working with the composition. Gone past, haven't I? Okay, the camera. The camera sees everything. It can be quite problematic. You can't hide many things in a dome. Generally, we're using something like a 180-degree lens because that matches the dome surface, particularly for astronomy shows. But if you're doing a show where you want to show the ground plane, you need much wider. You need something like a 210-degree field of view. So again, you're capturing even more stuff that on screen. I'll talk about camera movement. Camera movement tends to be much slower. It can really make people motion sick in a dome very quickly if you're moving stuff around very, very rapidly on the screen there. I like to use a lot of crane shots and dolly shots because they work particularly well. In fact, I remember I was doing a particular project on, it was a widescreen format, which are very similar to Cinerama. And if anyone knows about Cinerama, it was made up of three cameras pointing in three directions, made a huge widescreen thing. And they couldn't tilt the camera. As soon as they tilted the camera, it mucked up their horizons, and actually was in contact with some people about that, and they said, no, just use crane shots. And it's amazing, they just use crane shots and dolly shots, and they are really effective ways of moving through worlds and enhancing that sort of sense of immersion. Editing's another particularly different sort of thing that we have to consider. You can't use close-ups, you can't cut to a close-up of a scientist suddenly. You know, you don't want heads that big across the dome. It's not going to look very good. Direct cuts can be very disorienting because you imagine you're taking a person in the blink of an eye from one space into a completely different environment. So direct cuts can be quite difficult and disorienting. I mean, if you want to do that, you can. So we tend to use lots of cross dissolves and fades to black because they're much more effective. Also, how do you get things onto the screen? How do you bring a new element into the scene if you're trying to avoid cutting too much? Well, you can bring things up from behind the audience or up from the spring line, which is basically the horizon line, if you like. And the last point I've got there is just talking about the long shot. Now, the long shot, and particularly there was one particular show that I've seen called The Search for Life, and it's made up of one shot. Now, that's one way of avoiding cutting and editing in the show. But the problem for me with that show, and I mean, I love the show because it's got some brilliant animation in it, is that I find it exhausting. That I don't get a moment's rest. That I want to sort of stop and breathe and take in what I've sort of seen. So I actually prefer occasionally where we'll go, okay, we'll just fade to black, give the audience a chance to catch up, think about what they've sort of seen, and then move on to the next piece. Okay, so that kind of covers all that I really wanted to talk about in terms of comparing some of the elements of film to full dome. I'm just going to leave you with a scene from our new show, which is our climate show. The scene's called Paper World. Basically, it's a evocative sort of look at the last 250 years of the Industrial Revolution and that's impact upon Earth, I guess. And it's called Paper World. It was inspired partially by a Danish artist called Peter Callesen, who does these most exquisite paper cuts work. And what I really liked about it was the whole idea that paper is in this incredibly malleable sort of material used for a huge variety of things, yet it's fragile in its own sense. So I'll just play that piece for you.
Hi, I'm Scott Hessels, and I'm an independent filmmaker. I've been working in a lot of different mediums, so Full Dome is just one of them. I was teaching at UCLA, and I'm now at a tech university in Singapore. As a media artist, I generally mix new technologies with cinema. I do a lot of cinema-generating systems. So the artwork I'm going to talk about is a piece I did for Dome called Celestial Mechanics, which visualizes the hardware in the sky above us. So instead of stars and planets, the astronomy application, these are the machines that are drifting around above us. At about any given moment, there can be 30,000 man-made objects in the sky above us. And, you know, so we've got helicopters, satellites, weather balloons. This is space debris as tracked by NASA. We use all this stuff every day. Our lives are very closely connected to these networks in the sky. But unlike your mobile phone or your iPod, you never actually touch the hardware. You forget about these sort of hulking machines that are drifting directly above you. And because of that, you also sort of forget about the social and the economic and the political forces that put them up there. So you're using something and you're in compliance with something that you don't really know directly who controls. So this artwork was sort of a way to make you think about these things. The other thing that's sort of part of it is that scale is an important part of information. We now have the ability to collect tons of data, but like Chris pointed out, we still look at it on little 14-inch monitors. We have an incredibly well-documented world. So planetarium domes give us a capability to sort of return the sense of awe, the emotion that comes with statistics. Large data sets have a sense of wonder, and planetariums have always been very effective at creating wonder. So they give us the ability to visualize complex systems and keep the emotion that are important to that data tied to it. So I contacted dozens of government and scientific agencies around the world, and they gave me their data on various path technologies. And then I built a virtual dome in a software, and then plotted using programming codes each of the individual paths. So everything you're about to see from this video are actual paths and functions of machines that are in the sky above us. And then I kind of looked at the data and picked places on the planet where I thought the patterns were particularly beautiful, and then sort of worked with a team of animators and designers at UCLA to sort of aesthetically visualize it. And we messed around with the data quite a bit. So it was never meant to be a specific scientific tool. It was meant to be an artistic piece. George Lucas read about the piece online and wrote to me and gave me Skywalker Sound for free. And they did the audio for the piece, which was pretty amazing, although it has that Star Wars kind of rumble, you know. So anyway, the non-path technologies like helicopters, model rockets, weather balloons, that was collected as protocols. So the Los Angeles Fire Department gave me their protocol of how they collect water and put out brush fires up in the hills above Los Angeles. ABC News gave me the protocol for collecting traffic information from helicopters. And the Los Angeles Police Department gave me the coordinates and the actual path and the journey of an actual car chase through downtown Los Angeles. So here's our stylized version of that. And if we have audio. So Los Angeles International Airport gave me the sound patterns of planes landing over downtown Los Angeles, and we visualized the audio waves of those particular sound patterns of landing planes. The Federal Aviation Administration gave me every plane over America, longitude, latitude, and altitude every 3 minutes over a 12-hour period of time, which is about 20 to 25,000 planes. And then we visualized that. This section here, so this is air traffic over the U.S. So this is midday. In a minute, you'll see the middle of the night. That section of the piece was in the Museum of Modern Art in New York just last year, who, of course, took it off the dome, put it on a little monitor about this big. National Weather Service gave us the 1,100 launch sites of all weather balloons around the world and their times, and we visualized how they rise, transmitting data, and then burst and then drift back down to Earth. And NASA gave us all the data of all the satellite systems, the different layers of satellite systems in the sky above us. This image is from the two GPS networks. There's three now, the Russian and the U.S. GPS satellites. This view would be roughly about 2 miles below the surface of the Earth at the North Pole, just to give you an idea of how we sort of chose locations regardless of where they were physically. And we also sort of stylized how they triangulate. So. The geostationary ring is a ring of satellites that drifts directly above the equator. These are your mobile phone satellites coming into line of sight with the geostationary ring. And so you're making your phone call across the world. It's bouncing off that ring. And Motorola gave me this data. And then the low Earth orbiting satellites, which is the next clip I'm going to show you, are the actual sort of science and research satellites that are drifting right above you. So this is sped up about 400 times, but these are the actual satellite paths and movements that are directly above you right now. After a couple of seconds, you're going to see their footprint. So you're going to get a visualization of what they're looking at, how much of the Earth each one of those satellites sees. So each of the data sets came in independently, very separately, and they completely ignored the other data sets. Everybody was only keeping track of their own data. Nobody cared about anything else going on out there. NASA tracks about two-thirds of it, maybe half of it, but nobody controls it. And everything is launched. Even Motorola told me they just launch a satellite and hope they don't hit anything else. There's so much real estate up there, there's no concern about congestion yet. They're completely cavalier about it. There's a sort of an American old Wild West attitude going on. But what we noticed while we were doing this is that relationships became visible that were never part of the individual data sets. Airplanes, while they fly, collect weather information. But after 9/11, there were no airplanes, and they realized that all those jet trails from those 20,000 planes were changing the weather. So technologies are responding and adapting in response to other technologies that are up there. So there's an adjustment. The hardware and the software are demonstrating behaviors that were never really originally planned or coded into their original design. So there's some sort of weird emergence going on up there. I don't know if it's, what was the movie, Total Recall or Terminator, where the machines will take over. But something's going on up there that isn't quite planned. The other side of it, though, too, is that many of these patterns that we're seeing up there are becoming part of our semiotic language. You know, that shaky blue circle of light from a police helicopter, that's very culturally coded, and it's as culturally coded as the image of, you know, military airplanes flying in a perfect V formation, or the melancholy dissipation of jet trails. You know, centuries ago, people looked into the sky and they saw patterns, and they developed a whole mythology around it. And I think now we're applying cultural significance to the new patterns that are appearing above us. We're creating a whole new set of constellations. So technology is generating a mythology, in a sense. So this piece is trying to use the planetarium to sort of look at the cultural meaning that we're attaching to some of the movement and patterns above us. So if you're interested in the project, there's a website up for it that has the videos, it has the data sets, pretty much everything we worked on. If you're interested in some other stuff that I've banged out, you can go to my website. And that's about it. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Okay, I'm Peter Morse. I've been working in visualization for many years now, I guess, in different sorts of varieties. And I thought what I'd do today is just run, tell you about some of my sort of practice and research and some of the full dome materials that I've been developing and other technologies that I'm interested in working with. So my background is really being a kind of nerdy school kid doing Super 8 animations and so on when I was about 14 or whatever, cut out sort of Doctor Who things and so on, and then moving through video and the big, you know, sort of reel-to-reel things in the 90s, sort of late 70s and 80s, and then not getting wireless networks. Then I did a lot of work when I was at art school with computer-controlled slide projectors, which was the corporate medium par excellence, where you get you can basically project 35mm slides on enormous screens, and these were run with Roadrunners and very old sort of XT, IBM computers and so on. And then from that, I've sort of moved through a lot of 3D animation, stereoscopic production, and now onto dome materials. An abiding passion I've had through all of this is Antarctica, and I'll be playing some stuff about my sort of Antarctic-related work and so on, and then look at also run you through some of the stereoscopic projects and an abiding interest I have in real-time environments and virtual reality environments. Those sorts of practices also colliding now with data visualization, because I'm very interested in working with scientists and how you can sort of display and visualize science, and how things like full dome and so on and stereoscopy can provide utility for scientists working in particular disciplines and enable them to see their data in new and insightful ways to enable them with intuition. And then finally, I'll just mention Benthos. I'm the very fortunate recipient of an ANAT Synapse grant or fellowship or bursary or whatever it's called to work with the Australian Antarctic Division visualising marine science data. So I've had a long interest in Antarctica, and I was living in Europe for a number of years and then returned to Australia in 1999, and having got a lecturing position at the Victorian College of the Arts and the University of Melbourne, where I basically ran their new media programs in computer animation and probably into some programming, sort of web development, stuff like that. And I've been reading a book about Douglas Mawson, his biography by Philip Ayres, who was a professor of English out at Monash University. And I phoned up Professor Ayres because there was a photograph, a glass plate, in this biography of Mawson that was a stereoscopic pair taken with an old stereoscopic camera during the 1911 to 14 Australasian Antarctic expedition. And I've become aware then of Paul Burke, who I'm sure everyone is going to mention today, Paul Burke, the missing character here. And phoned him up out of the blue and said, look, you know, I'm aware that you're doing the stereoscopic stuff out at Swinburne Astrophysics, supercomputing and so on. How about going for an ARC grant together? So we were trying to get an Illumens Vision Station at that stage. And so I sort of developed a relationship with him, now a working relationship over the last 10 years. I was also at that time tracking down these images from the Mawson Collection, which is here at the Museum of South Australia. And, of course, old stereoscopic glass plates, stereoscopic projection technologies, you know, the light bulb goes off. Yes, we can look at images from 1911 to 14, 100 years ago in 3D on the big screen and make them interactive. And so that there's an interesting possibility of data retrieval from old images, because normally these are seen in a one-to-one relationship in a Wheatstone viewer. And so that creates it alters the spectatorial relationship that you have and the investigative one. That led on to the production of a 22-minute film, Home of the Blizzard, which shows permanently at the Tasmanian Museum and Art Gallery. I'm trying to get it here, showing in South Australia, because obviously it's strongly identified with Mawson. And we've had about 800,000 people gone through seeing that movie over the last 3 years, so it's been very successful. I've also been involved with a number of projects with the Australian Antarctic Division and the Mawson's Huts Foundation, and this has led to me going down last summer, not the summer that we're having now, but last year, down to Mawson's Huts and shooting full-dome content down there and also HD stereoscopic video with a view to compositing all these different types of data together to make a sort of, you know, a narrative visualization of some sort. So, and I'll play some examples of these. Actually, I will play a little example now to give you an idea of what I'm talking about. This is just a short promo movie. Remote sensing satellite data sets, so the RAMP 2 data set of Antarctica, which is a very high resolution digital elevation model, and interfacing that with a lot of other climate data and things like that. And then the idea behind that was this was actually made before I actually went down to Mawson's Huts in Antarctica, and I was very happy when I actually got there to see that it was actually a fairly accurate model of it. So it was a kind of fantasy that became real for me. And then I'm interfacing this with the series of slides by Frank Herbert. So these are anyway. I'll just scan through this quickly. What's remarkable about these images is that they are very small glass plates, about this big, and because they're photographic, there's an enormous amount of detail in them. So I'd scan them at something like 3600 dpi, so you're virtually scanning the film grain And that enables you to then blow these up to enormous scale and also archaeologically retrieve information from them. So I could find out what books the Antarctic explorers were reading, because they would be up on their bookshelf. And nobody's seen that sort of data for 100 years. So I know that Watson was reading The White Company by Arthur Conan Doyle, for example. And that was something that you wouldn't be aware of. So, you know, of interest to people, Antarctic historians and so on. So working with that, that led me to produce Blizzard and then Sensation of Ice at TMAG and so on, and that was also shown as a multi-screen stereoscopic projection at the Festival of Perth for the International Polar Year in 2006. And that's also led on to a common interest that Paul and I have with working with the Unity game engine to look at how we can bring this data into sort of real-time environments. And then I've also been doing some work with the Jeffrey Shores group up at iCinema, the AVI, showing the stereoscopic, fully cylindrical panoramic stuff from Antarctica as well. And an example of what one can do with a game engine, for example, I hope this is going to work here, is... This is not... We can change the geometry of this for arbitrary projection. This is an anaglyphic stereoscopic walkthrough of a model of Mawson's hut. So we can walk around the insides of the huts here and then walk into full dome panoramas, which are... And these are stereo panoramas of the environment. So one could project this on a full dome environment. Our participants walking around the hut, or whatever, would be an interesting question of who's driving you around inside the hut, and move between this sort of photographic documentation of the environment, which is useful for conservators, materials conservators, archaeologists, and so on, perhaps visitors. A tourist ship going down there, because we also have a version of this that runs on the iPhone app store. It runs pretty slowly at the moment, so I think that we need to optimize. That's some cool bonus we'll talk about. And this takes outside so we can see what the environment is. So this is the workshop area. We're looking through to the main living area there. And then we can walk outside into the environment. This is Cape Denison, so we have a fully spherical environment here with the huts and other spheres located at various photo points that I've attempted to match with shots that early himself had taken. So the idea there is to get a pretty, highly realistic, interactive representation of the Antarctic environment around Mawson's huts. So go back here. That led on, as I mentioned, to using the AV system, and I'll just quickly put a lot of videos to play here. I think I have it here. Let's see. Holographic. No, it's not that one there. No, I don't think I actually have that movie in my little folder, unfortunately. But it was just an example of showing a full cylindrical surround stereoscopic system. So it's really just taking those spheres and mapping them onto a large-scale cylindrical immersive system, stereoscopic system. What I'm very interested in now is looking at data visualization. I was very happy to see Scott's work and so on, because that, for me, that's a really fascinating sort of field. One can spend hours and hours and hours working, doing computer animation and modeling and so on, as I'm sure Warwick's all too aware. It can be exhausting work, and but you're sort of inventing data and so on. And I'm very keen to work with actual data about the real world and looking at how we can model and visualize that. So I'm currently working with a lot of marine science data, working with material around the Cape Denison area and the Antarctic Ocean and so on. And I'll quickly I will. One thing I realised I've just missed was the actual dome show that I made about Mawson's Hut. So I'll put this up on the screen here. I need to get my hard drive. Yep. Yeah, sure. Just take a second to mount. And this is this was commissioned by Horizon Planetarium in Perth, and this is I stood atop Azimuth Hill in the eternal wind, looking across the immense ice cliffs of Commonwealth Bay. A cacophony of Adelie penguins screeched and fought as I spied the huts in the distance. Beside the memorial cross to Ninus and Mertz, a deathful tragedy of this place, under the endless azure sky. Because I'm running out of time, I'll just quickly skip ahead to one of my favourite scenes here. This is Hurley's Dark Room, which is about 1.2 metres square.
Good timing.
Now seen for the first time in a new image, as Frank Hurley himself experimented with new ways of seeing. On the shelves, the fascinating array of chemicals, pyrogallic acid, the forgotten chemistry of century-old photography, the development trays and baths. And on the floor, a congealed mass of frozen things. So anyway, you get the idea there. I'll quickly skip ahead just to the synapse stuff that I'm working on with the ocean visualization. I'm indicating here that I've done a lot of audio production work with Paul and so on, and we've recently done a shoot of stromatolites at the doing underwater sort of scuba full dome up at Shark Bay in Western Australia, and my most recent work is really all about marine science and underwater environments and so on, because this is tied in with work that I'm doing for the Census of Marine Life and the Census of Antarctic Marine Life, which are very large multi-billion dollar international science projects. And just to give you an idea of the results that we're getting from this, I've got a couple of QTVRs which will eventually be turned into, or Monica's actually putting these into the dome show. So this is an example of an underwater QTVR. These are stromatolites, which are about 5,000 to 7,000 years old. Some of the earliest life forms on the planet that caused all of us to be here by producing the oxygen atmosphere that we breathe. So this was a pretty interesting and technically challenging exercise to shoot full dome environments underwater, because you've got a lot of stuff going on around you to deal with. This also ties in with visualizing the entire global ocean, which I'm working with Paul and I. This is hot off the press, a couple of days. This is the Earth, seen from the center of the Earth, minus any land. And so this is the GEBCO data set, which is a global topographic bathymetric data set, extracted from what's known as the WSG-84 geoid, which is the mean sea level of the Earth. And so it's a very complex kind of fractal shape, the Earth. And what's been very interesting about developing this is that we don't really see the shape of the ocean. The question that popped into my head is, what is the shape of the ocean, the global ocean? Because we have this enormously terrestrial view of the Earth, whereas, of course, if you were a sentient being of some sort living in the seas, all the continents would be the blank spaces on the map. And the sea would be the familiar. So we've got all the areas that you see here are the shallow areas of the ocean, and so on. And I'll finish up now. And so this is one new way of looking at the global oceans, and also using volumetric visualization software, Drishti, to actually have a 3D volume that one can navigate through. So all this stuff is going to be worked together into a full dome production about the oceans. And that's it. I'll get off. Okay, thank you.
Hi, everyone. I'm focusing on performance and looking at the production of the work Future Memory, which premiered here for the Adelaide Film Festival. What was interesting, and what I have a curiosity for, as well as Alexander Waite Mitchell, my collaborator, who's just in the front row, is the effect on performers and the effect on the audience. So phenomenology is used to examine the lived body and experience through performance processes. And when considering the tripartite perspective, you have the director, the choreographer, B, the performer, and C, the audience, and that nexus in the middle there. People shift in and out of playing all three roles during any given performance. This experience can be heightened and engaged within full dome, and that functions to allow the audience to be in the experience, or an environmental scene, a response to a filmed person looking or turning back at you, a perceived movement without actual movement in response to the angle of the visuals. Merleau-Ponty came up with this philosophy of phenomenology, which relies on the attempt to approach the world experientially in the now, and I really believe that full dome format brings the audience into this intersubjectivity, so that you're really experiencing and being in the moment. And I guess ultimately that's the aim. This is a framework for discussing the ontology of characters and the experience of being an audience member, shifting towards becoming involved in the performance, something promoted by full dome format. Merleau-Ponty discusses the accessibility of characters made possible when in direct contact. And we sort of exist within this space, and the image is all around us, obviously, within full dome. So we're not just experiencing, but we're actually put right in the middle of it. The research explores the interacting and dynamic forces of the theatrical medium. You have body, space, sound, process, and product. And this facilitates a time-space aesthetic experience for the performing self to be realised and acknowledged. The performing self is a given body in the state of performing and connected to the state of performance, such as a dancer or an actor. However, the notion of performance and film in full dome format gives credence to the audience also being an integral performer, as discussed before. Imaginary worlds and fictional characters are entities within a realm of imaginative processes that are very real but unquantifiable. On a flat screen or in a theatre, we watch the action from afar through that fourth wall. And in full dome, obviously, that fourth wall is ultimately removed. Full dome format throws into question ideas about performance as a contract between the audience and the action. It challenges the notion of suspended reality, and it considers the spectator again as a performer. In the book Body Spaces, Merleau-Ponty is quoted as saying that experience discloses beneath objective space in which the body eventually finds its place. Primitive spatiality of which experience is merely the outer covering and which merges with the body's very being. To be a body is to be tied to a certain world. Our body is not primarily in space, it is of space. And so it made me think about, why is full dome so powerful for an audience? And the answer, it could be an answer, it could actually generate a lot more questions as well. It's identified perhaps in this quotation here by Stanton B. Garner in his book Bodied Spaces. That he states that even the act of seeing discloses its source in the phenomenal realm and in the body that represents its spatial location. The embodied I, the self of theatrical spectatorship, is grounded in an embodied I. So much is felt and sensed just through looking as one of the senses. My core collaborator, Alexander Waite Mitchell, and I created the Full Dome Dance Work Future Memory. And this was really a work that we developed from the very, very beginning with this hemispherical capture and movement of the body through the hemispherical lens, which was 180 by 180 degrees. Several factors affected and influenced the final work. Firstly, the framing. Where the dancer was placed in space and where they were captured in the frame could not be manipulated in post-production. So it stayed at that same reference point. We couldn't zoom in post-production because that would change the warping and the perspective that had been caught in the can. Secondly, to gain the high resolution, we actually filmed with a stills camera. So the dancers and I entered a process of beginning action and then having to pause the action for the camera to buffer, holding that frame, and then for the dancers to continue the movement. So if you can imagine that process, there was a lot of stopping and starting and absolute stillness in that moment that you call action as a director. So it throws a whole new light on the word action itself. Thirdly, there's obviously issues with green screening. And if you think of a hemispherical fisheye lens and you're thinking of, for instance, if this grey line here is the green screen, if you were filming with a normal frame or a rectangular frame, the hand would be in. As soon as you start moving forward and coming forward, slight movement causes a body part to be out. So there was a lot of actual... we tried as much as we could to create a circular green screen, but obviously in an ideal world you'd actually need to film within a complete green room and probably not even be in the room yourself as camera operators, you know, sort of feed the camera in from above or below, which could be very interesting and in due course, hopefully. You can call us a little mad, but that was sort of how we felt during the process. So Alex and I keyed out, you know, we had to key out the green, but we also had to also hand cut fingers and feet that fell out of frame of the green screen. So this picture here is taken, or this stills from the work in the last scene, and the sweet spot that everyone's talking about is this sort of bottom quadrant. I sort of feel actually, and it is obviously debatable because I feel a bit differently than some of the other people on the panel today, that when you're talking about experimental and narrative work, that some of these rules about close-ups and about where the spectator should be and horizon lines, I feel we need to explore. And as a choreographer and director, I'm quite open to exploring close-up and to exploring how to affect the perspective of that audience member. To have a dancer over the top of you and then suddenly pull back to a totally different perspective, I think is definitely worth researching and something that Alex and I would like to continue doing. This, however, uses the sweet spot. The image before actually came across what I would say this left-hand side of the body, and so the dancer was quite quite large in terms of, or quite over-empowering. Whereas I think this was a little bit more naturally acceptable to the human eye. Anyway, you can create different rhythms in space with the audience and also with the performer. Future Memory was filmed entirely in South Australia, in the studio, as I said, and also on location. And just in finishing, a couple of things that definitely influenced with the hemispherical filming and the cinematic language came actually from the format we were using, came from the use of hemispherical space and the hemispherical lens. I started thinking as a choreographer about impossible movement, movement on the ceiling, which may seem quite obvious, but what I was more interested in was capturing... Really? What I was more interested in doing was capturing... we'll just say okay and hopefully it'll behave itself. What I was more interested in capturing was not just movement that went and swung across the space, but movement that was literally impossible. So you'd have a dancer, say, for instance, in a coiled fetal position that could move. So no movement or stillness creating movement, which I think is very, very special. And I don't really know another format that can achieve that. It's definitely something that we'd like to keep on doing. And when I look at the final product, and again, the product is still in process... I sort of think that that type of footage is quite special with working with illusion. Shifting perspective again that I discussed before, the ability to be able to have a close-up dancer and quite a large face looking at you takes this medium away from what I would call traditional stage space, where on a stage, if you went to the Adelaide Festival Centre Playhouse and you had actors or dancers on stage, they might be performing or projecting their lines and their text or in a scene to the whole audience. But when you're actually looking at this format, I think there's a little bit of the Mona Lisa, well, let's name it the Mona Lisa sort of theory or something that has that quality to it. It's almost a one-on-one sense, and that is something that we also found with the 3D stereographic work that we've been working within for the last 2 years, is that there's this sense that the performer is almost performing just for you, no matter where you're sitting in the space. Whereas if you go and sit in a traditional cross-arch theatre, the performer is performing for everybody. I guess, again, depending on what's going through your head, these things are all just points to discuss and think about. I think that it's, again, a very timely mix of Alex and I really had to look at where the technology was at and where what we wanted to explore. And we really tried to work within the parameters. And in working within the parameters of the limits of that technology, we were able to not look at things as limitations or barriers, but say, these are the facts, we need to work with this. Let's hold the camera here. We need to run 100 metres away and create this big, long extension cord to actually shoot because we were in the frame. These limitations actually created, some of the... It's a little bit like what was being discussed before. You can't zoom, so you decide to use a crane and you decide to keep the camera still. And these are the conditions, and so you have to go with those conditions, but it does define the work for now. Well, we've gone very big and large there. I'd like to leave you with just a thought that has always, always perplexed me, mainly for the last decade, honestly, when I saw Derek Jarman's autobiographical work, Blue. And I think it's at the end of the film that the words just come across the screen. It's text-driven, it's just a blue screen, this piece. And he says, if the windows of perception were to be wiped clean, then we would see clearly. And I think when you're considering full-dome format and what it can do to you as an audience member in terms of taking on that role of almost creating your own reality in that moment and also, I guess, experiencing, there's a lot of relevance within thinking about, you know, who am I in this space and what is reality as such. And I guess that's the beauty of art mirroring life. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Monica. I'm from Melbourne Planetarium. I'm sorry I don't have a PowerPoint presentation. I was just going to have a few words about, what it's like being a producer of full-dome content and where I think it's going to be heading. And first of all, I just want to say thank you very much to Vicky and Annette for organising this symposium because, as I was saying to her last night, we people who work in full-dome don't get much of a chance to collaborate or even meet each other. And it's great that someone from the outside perspective can sort of like lump us in one room and get us to sort of talk and exchange ideas like this. It's really exciting. My background is pretty much a traditional film production model before I started working in planetariums and cinema studies. And that's the one exciting thing about working in the dome is that you do get to work with people who have very different backgrounds, you know, film backgrounds, IT backgrounds, science backgrounds, cultural theory backgrounds, but we're all working towards this emerging screen language that it's very exciting and it's a new experience. And the fact that it is a total immersive experience is its strength, but it also can be a bit of a drawback because you're creating content that can really only be experienced in a dome. And it's very hard to get people into domes sometimes, or domes to them, which is what's going to be happening more and more, I think, with portable domes, which is good. And I think the other exciting thing now is that there is the full dome now is becoming slightly more consistent in terms that we are getting more opportunities, you know, day by day to exchange work with each other across the world and across the internet. Even we can download other people's files and put them up in our domes and start actually seeing other people's work, whereas a couple of years ago that was nearly impossible. I think there are some interesting collaborations that I'm aware of. We were approached by the Belgian Off Art Zone, which was supported by the Ministry of Trade. They want to do a dome project using a collaboration with scientists from the Denmark Summer School and Balinese astronomers and do some work in Indonesia. I've been approached by film director and producer Robert Connolly. He wants to do a documentary about Hulse, the planet suite, in the dome. You know, so suddenly it's sort of getting on people's radar that this is a really interesting and exciting space and language to work with. At the Melbourne Planetarium, we do a show every 18 months. It's, up till now, it's all been astronomy-based. We just have a very small team. It's myself. I tend to bring on board up to three animators for each show. Luckily, I've managed to get Warwick to work on most of them, another animator called Dermot Egan, Ben Tiefholz. I think it's important to work with people who get the language of the dome, obviously, and to get the language of the dome, you have to have done it, you know, numerous times. And we just work with the animators. I then bring on board music and sound people, and, you know, it follows a traditional model from there. But the actual distribution of dome content is a sort of interesting and sometimes confusing proposition, because at the moment, most of the distributors of dome content are also the suppliers of the delivery system. So, for instance, Skyscan will set up the dome for you and they will give you some product that they've either produced themselves or they've sourced from other planetariums. So it'd be interesting to see what's going to happen in the future, whether there'll be more independent distribution models that we can start using, and, yeah, what the commercial kind of implications of that will be. So, yeah, I guess my dream is that, you know, Melbourne Planetarium and it will become the sort of production hub for, you know, dome content, and that there'll be more, collaborative opportunities. That's really all I need to say.
Good morning. I'm sorry. I say that way too often. My name is David Byrne. I'm from the University of New Mexico in the southwestern part of the United States. I'm the associate director of a small research lab called the Arts Lab, and I'm the titular director of DomeFest. And what I thought I would do for you in trying to follow really, really smart people is just give you a little context from Full Dome from my experience, and then some allegory from some of the pieces that were submitted. How many of you have seen the DomeFest show? Yeah? You did, Jack? Joe, you did? Great. So I'm going to use some of those pieces in just stills as allegory. So that's me. That's where you find me. Where am I here? So the context of the whole thing is we were quite early in Albuquerque to commission a full dome theater. It was called Lodestar. We commissioned it in 97, opened it in 99, and it was one of the first. So, and there was very little content. In designing the space, I was able to lean on some really dear friends. New Mexico's is a deeply wealthy place in talent, with a lot of experience, a lot of experience and talent from IMAX, and friends that I was able to lean on in designing this thing. So two people were really important. Ben Shedd, who produced two of the finest IMAX films of all time, Academy Award winner for Short Doc, helped. And then Michael Stearns, who's a composer and sonic designer, he worked in Kronos and Baracus, a lot of other things on the audio side. So I was working with those two friends in designing the space, along with Steve Savage, the president of Skyscan. So we threw out the idea of it as a theater. I thought Warwick really demonstrated that well. Instead, it's a time-space machine. It's an experiential device, not a theater. So we built this thing up. It's a 18-meter, roughly 18-meter dome, tilted 25 degrees forward with the seats inclined to point to everyone's nose at the zenith. And it was quite early in that kind of design, but again, Ben and I and Steve were designing towards motion, towards design space, to enhance the sense of motion and moving people through and creating a strong horizon line when we wanted to. So while working with Ben and Michael and Steve, you know, they kept beating on me. Michael and Ben were both early in IMAX and tried to experiment in that deeply expensive medium. Co-founded something called Big Shorts, which was an attempt to do experimental works in IMAX. It lasted for a year or two before corporate support just withered away. So they were saying, you have a playground. You have this opportunity to do things that we couldn't do 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and you better do something with it. It's like, yes, sirs. And concomitantly, you know, we're opening this thing, and but it's the geodesic, the exterior geodesic dome, which is about 22 meters, built in next door, and then walked down the street. And when Jenny jokingly calls me a, and it's absolutely a joke, a visionary, this is my vision. It's like, oh shit, we're building it. Now what are we gonna do? So anyway, we're part of the university. There was no content. There was maybe, what, Jack, 20 minutes of content in the Skyscan library, a couple shows in development. There was nothing. And it was a planetarium, and principally a planetarium. And, of course, that in especially in New Mexico, those things equate to $0 for production. So what are we going to do? I met Jack White, and we started talking about alternative content immediately before the solder was cool on the place. And started experimenting. Jack brought over a really wonderful filmmaker, Michaela French. We started experimenting with ideas. The opportunity and the need, along with just short experiments, really came to a simple conclusion of we got to start making things. So we started inviting faculty to create. And to jump forward just for a bit. This is Arts Lab, and that's what's really come out of it. So we started in 2000, we started teaching students how to make things from the media arts classes, the cinema arts classes, and the animation courses, which were cross-reference. And we started allowing students to create things, and more experiments came up, more and more great opportunities for the medium. It became really clear that this thing could communicate a lot of wonderful, wonderful expressions. And most importantly to me, and my formal training is more as a sociologist than anything, was that it was this democratizing medium that could create a very, very powerful voice for very many different types of people. So some of the earliest works that I'm still most proud of at UNM were done by Native Americans, a piece called Indigenous Skies by a Diné, a Navajo woman, Colleen Gorman. A lot of people pushing in boundaries like that. So jump forward just real quickly. Arts Lab, is we established that in 2005, built a small research dome. You'll notice the overlap. We have multiple projectors, even though it's a 4.5-meter dome. So we're trying to focus on the multi-pipe stuff. It's more difficult, but it allows us to work both in small domes like here and in the large domes. So DomeFest really came out of all these student experiments and started supporting independent artists in New Mexico from 2000 to 2003. Each semester, students would bring their works in, and we'd put 250 people in a 150-seat theater and just have a ball, watch absolutely atrocious stuff and some really, really beautiful stuff. So in 2003, we collaborated with a local film festival, Duke City Shootout, and we just internally juried a work of all the students. And that was kind of the genesis of it. 2004, we formally branded it with the deeply original name Dome Fest, and invited a jury, invited the world to start submitting short works. So we've been doing that. We took 2006 off so I could come hang out with Jack and everyone in Melbourne for the International Planetarium Society. And we return again this year. So what I wanted to do is just show you a few of the pieces, just as stills. I'm not comfortable showing other people's works in a medium that's not intended, that they didn't design for, so they're simply stills. But I think there's a lot of allegories in these pieces that hopefully have some benefit to you. First is Hugh Walker's piece that's in the retrospective here, Derivation of Chaos. Hugh's deeply important personally and professionally. She's with me at the Arts Lab. She's a master artist who's continually evolved from pencil to paint to video, now to full dome. And she's also been our principal instructor. But she, you know, unquestionably designed, took over the dome as a fine art venue. And she's been exploring the works and supporting the students and creating experiential, consciousness-based pieces that, you know, I think more than anyone has proven concept of full dome as a fine art venue. Next up, I just want to Optical Nervous System by the brilliant and heretical David McConville, really good friend. You'll find the piece that Scott's edited, new edition of Filter. You find his piece in there. This one, I still show every student that comes through. The allegories here are, one is he is deeply interested in environment and perception. So he collaborated with the Alan Watts archives, grabbed a snippet of Alan Watts's a lecture, and did this, did the visuals all by himself with just a digital SLR and a laptop and Adobe products. And it's a deeply powerful piece, and it just showed, the democratization and the opportunity for narrative, an alternative narrative, and to really get the world thinking about perception and how the dome relates to that. Another piece that you'll see or have seen in the show is one of my all-time favorites. I love the guys. All these people are friends, so I'm entirely biased. But Molecularium by Owen and Kurt is this brilliant child's fantasy through the world of the molecular scale. And things that are really, really wonderful about it, it's one of the first pieces I was done that was trying to do science education for young people that's non-astronomical, that had some success. Kurt, by the way, is a trained hypnotist, and you'll hear that in the words and the songs. Oh, it's a musical. And just kind of taking that bringing that childhood to life. So it has this wonderful bubblegum kind of quality to it, but the molecules were all based and moved based in science simulation. They were partnering with Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and they're actually plowing in simulation in supercomputers, plowing a buckyball, a carbon-60 molecule, through the elements that you see in the show. And that data was exported and imported into Maya, so these little bubblegummy molecules are actually moving as they do in nature, according to science simulation. So it just runs this wonderful gamut of very high tech to hypnotism. Brilliant. Second City is in the show as well, and it's a good example of the opportunities and limitations of live capture. Others have mentioned, you know, the resolution, frame rate are still very, very, very challenging issues in full dome because of the resolution. But live capture, you know, it has a quality to it that CG just can't bring. Matt did this again. This is just independent work. He runs a small studio called Dome 3D. But again, just example of how you can really create a quite impressionable experiences with not a whole lot of hardware. On the entirely opposite scale, Donna Cox and Bob Patterson at the National Center for Supercomputing Application, really famous video that I worked with them to repurpose for the Dome. It's a 20-year-old, I think it's almost 20 years old, science simulation and visualization, but it has this really, really wonderful quality to it. And again, just trying to give you examples of where you can go with the medium in this kind of didactic, diagrammatic stuff that can come out of genuine collaboration between artists and scientists. And Donna is a fine artist who can live with the scientists, which is brilliant and rare. Another example for you, Dome Sketch by my really good friend Ryan Wyatt. Ryan's a very talented science visualizer. So for Dome Fest 2005, I think, he threw it all on its head and did hand-drawn imagery for the dome. They were done. He scribed a circle using a CD, so you have the scale. Did the geometry correction in his head while sitting in Central Park in Times Square, Soho, I think that is. And then use open source software to move the pictures. Very, very simple approach. Very, very different than his day job. Another one, generative computational landscapes, doesn't hold up so great in low resolutions like we have here. But the generative art form is one that I'm deeply excited about as a medium or as a process for full dome submission. If you see this one, Jared Tarbell is the principal. He's an acclaimed algorithm artist, and he just auditioned his existing code to work in the dome. So there's no geometry happening here. So I just wanted to make sure you know the point that, you know, you don't have to be a slave to the shape of the dome. You can let the shape of the dome just work for you. And so he just auditioned different codes and put them together to the music of Michael Stearns. Check his stuff out. It's all open source. Levitated.net, I should have put it on here. But really brilliant. And algorithm and generative is something we're really pushing within UNM as a really wonderful expression and method. And then lastly, this one, Moonlight, Andrew Quinn is an Australian filmmaker. I love the piece. It has fantasy, it has whimsy. It's using 3D CG, but he's just putting us in this space, in this world of his, and it's really wonderful. So on those levels, but what I really wanted to point out is the need and the opportunities that artists in residencies provide. So this wonderful Australian filmmaker had to hike over to Switzerland in order to make this piece in a rarefied artists in residence program. And so what I want to say to that is that, you know, I think if you watch the Dome Fest pieces and everything you heard from these people, is the opportunities are tremendous, and but the resources are few. And you know, Dome Fest is I feel like a thief, and because I can't pay the artists yet, and people work very deeply hard on it. So finding these kind of opportunities to fund people to create these things and to move it forward. So those are kind of my allegories, and from some of the pieces that I hope you've enjoyed or will enjoy this evening. The medium, clearly growing. Jenny mentioned there's more than 500 in the world. The quality of what I'm seeing at a Dome Fest, more pieces, better pieces, and more innovation. Did I miss a slide? There's one more I wanted to mention. In that regard, I missed my slide. It's a Skiophobia 2.5D piece that you saw or hopefully will see. Two German university students, undergraduates, produced it. Won Best of Festival in 2008, demonstrating the strength of the youth in this stuff. But to my point, though, is that so the younger people are creating better work, which is probably the most exciting thing for me. The production values continue to go up. The processes, which I tried to hint in these allegories, keep evolving. And there are a lot more I didn't mention. I think the stuff that Scott's doing and Peter and data-driven things is deeply important and full of opportunity. Dome Fest is getting it around. Part of its intent is to create buy-in from the domes that exist, to show it's okay, you know, to do something that's not astronomical. People might really enjoy it, and if they do, maybe you could do more of this stuff for your community to support local artists and for the medium as a whole. So it's growing up, and to leave you, please come. July 16 through 19 is this year's Insanity. Love to have you. We'll be putting details up on domefest.org. We started a channel on Vimeo. You'll see all the clips that are in the show, all of 08. There's a lot there. So if you just go to Vimeo, and search for Domefest, you can watch a lot of things. And here's a few places to get a little more grounding. There's a Ning site, fulldome.ning, which is kind of young. There's a great Yahoo group called Fulldome. And at Arts Lab, you can find some tutorials, very basic primers for beginners, material that he wrote to try to get people started. And I really encourage people to read the writings of Ben Shedd. If you just Google him, it's a huge URL. Exploding the Frame, but he's been writing about the design principles of large format frameless environments for quite a while, especially driven by science education, but the constructs that he's working from apply to any kind of full-dome medium. So that's a rattle on. I'm sorry for rattling on, and I'm sorry for making you wait for that. Jeez, that's just not right. Thanks.
Thank you, David. Thank you. Sorry, we're running really late. Just wanted to know if anybody had any questions. Otherwise, we'll wrap up.